Welcome to week number eight. This is the podcast based upon the newsletter that we produce for Rex Salaam on a weekly basis. It's myself, Kirby Lakhranji, and Dawn Riddler. It's a lot of work that we put into this newsletter. We release it on a weekly basis. And it's not only a chance for us to be able to encapsulate our thoughts about what has happened in the week, but also to give you the opportunity to be able to think about a wide variety of subjects and how that potentially impacts on your financial journey, your financial life, and potentially the lives of others. So have a listen, and if you want a lot more detail, head over to the newsletter and go and read up about everything that we are talking about today. So just the week, Dow Jones up 1.3%, S&P 500 up 1.66%. You might have heard of a company called Nvidia. The market was a bit lackluster leading into this company's results, and then really took off as they beat on expectations. The NASDAQ, as you would expect it, is up 1.4%. The Euro Stoxx 50 is up 2.24% for the week, showing how Europe is starting to come back in quite a large way. And if we go across into Shanghai, that's up 4.85%. The China A50 is up 3.64%. The currency at 19.31 against the US dollar, just against the Great British Pound, 24.48, and against the Euro, 20.90. That just gives an indication of how the budget speech went on Wednesday. Now for a little bit more information around this whole topic, we are going to be talking about Argentina today, grey listing, China. We're going to talk about the budget low light, so to speak, and then a little bit about NVIDIA earnings and what that means from an international perspective. Dawn, let's start maybe back home here. You know, so we saw the budget speech happening on Wednesday. I don't think, as you wrote in your blog post around the budget, I don't think there was anything really, quite frankly, that was astounding in that budget. Apart, obviously, from the fact that they want to tap into some of their reserves, so to speak, that is busy lying with Treasury and the South African Reserve Bank at this stage. Other than that, it was really just, quite frankly, just the same, right?
As I always say with, you know, politicians specifically, they always couch their words very carefully. We all know, you know, they lie, right? And a lot of those lies are not just lies of commission. In other words, they say something that is a lie. That's Donald Trump's favorite trick. But it's the lies of omission, which is much more subtle. You usually have to be a little bit brighter in order to do a lie of omission. But one of the lies of omission that came through in the budget speech was a kind of almost a bait and switch. The Minister of Finance said, oh, we aren't increasing the fuel levy, and that is giving you back 4 billion rand. And, you know, quite frankly, horse manure, right? At the end of the day, price of fuel has never been as high as it is at the moment. The price of Brent crude, which is obviously the dollar price of Brent crude, is at the same level as it was this time last year. The only reason the petrol price is so much higher is because the rand has gone down the tubes in the last year, right?
Yeah.
Incredibly, in my opinion, disingenuous to go and say, oh, we're not increasing the fuel levy because, you know. In the newsletter, I give a bit of background on the fuel levy and why this is actually so irritating to do it. And the fuel levy, one of the things that I have always had a bugbear about the fuel levy is that it is not a ring-fenced levy. The Road Accident Fund, which is also added on to the petrol price, is a ring-fenced fund to be used to pay out in road accident. And, you know, it's a lovely big fat gravy train that continually goes bankrupt. We all know about that. Now, the general fuel levy is a massive amount of money that they consume. And in the newsletter, again, you can see how much that is. That is not ring fence. That goes into general treasury for them to use whatever they like, right? To buy chicken chicken at every parliamentary sitting, right? It is not used for infrastructure, to build more roads, to improve ports, or any of those kind of things that one would normally associate, oh, this must be to do with fuel. I mean, that's one of the biggest problems with this. It just is a part of the fat cat kitty that the government has become increasingly reliant on. You know, that is extremely annoying. So the other thing that they didn't do, and this is where it sort of lies, damn lies and statistics again, is that they did not move the tax brackets. As you know, there are about five tax brackets normally, and for years now, the tax bracket has moved sometimes below inflation, sometimes the lower end will go a bit more above inflation, but they will usually, as a good word, to say, oh, aren't we magnanimous? They will go and move those tax brackets slightly to keep up with inflation. Inflation's currently running about circa 5.1%. But they didn't even attempt to do that this year, right? And so you get what's called bracket creep. In other words, to all intents and purposes, your tax will have increased 5.1%.
Dawn, apart from all these things, I suppose the one thing that sticks out for me is that 150 billion that they're going to be tapping out of the South African gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account, which really is an accumulation of reserves that have built up over many, many, many years. Basically, it's got to do with the exchange rate fluctuation. As the rand has depreciated the last two decades, this account has continued to balloon in ZAR terms. So they're going to be tapping 150 billion over the period of the next 3 years in order to make sure that they can plug some of the holes, especially from a debt servicing perspective. Now, it almost feels as if they're starting to sell some of the family jewels in order to just keep their heads above water. And when you go back into an economic policy unit for the ruling party, they'll continue to talk about the National Democratic Revolution. They'll continue to call each other comrades. They'll continue to believe that the way in which they are implementing this continues to be the correct way. But alas, the fruits aren't there, so to speak. They're just not seeing the business activity. They're just not seeing any of the activity floating through the economy in order to ensure that they can back up and build higher and higher amounts of reserves and hex even create a surplus so that at some point they've actually got extra money so that they don't have to tap into these reserves on a continuous basis. And I mean, those are some of the things that I think is worrying for South Africa. If they continue to do this and if this continues along this way, there is a default risk. It gets to a point where they just don't have the capital available anymore. And when you default, you either have to do so in on your own, and then you quite frankly phone the IMF and the World Bank and you ask them for money, or you ask them to tap, to plug the hole. And they'll only really do it if you really push through the reforms that they think you need to be doing, rather than the other way around. And I think that's quite a dangerous place for the government to be. It must be something that worries them. And also just the footing around all this. I mean, in order to tap this reserve, you needed to go to Letsego Kanyago and you needed to ask him at the Reserve Bank. I can't believe he would have been happy about this because he would look at this and say, but why? You guys aren't running your normal accounts in the way that is conducive to running the country long term. You're now trying to tap into reserves over time. That's going to bode pretty badly for South Africa over the long term if you continue to do so.
And Kobe, I think when you have a look, and there is a chart in the newsletter as just how much, it's north of 350 billion rand a year debt servicing costs alone, right? Now, that has ballooned, that has doubled as a percentage of GDP, that has doubled over the since 1994, right? To all intents and purposes, those servicing costs should be nearer 150 billion, if not lower, than 350 billion. And what they're doing, well, they're not trying to do, they're just doing it clearly, is not just sticking their paws in the piggy bank, they're breaking the piggy bank. And it's not the first time they do it. I don't know if you remember several years back, and it flew far too much under the radar for my liking. I mean, I tried to sort of raise the awareness of it, but nobody seemed to be interested on. Do you remember when they went and sold the entire fuel reserves?
I remember that.
When it was, at $20 a barrel, when it was at the lowest point it had been for decades, they sell our entire fuel reserves and they've never built it back again. So heaven forbid we get into a situation. And let's face it, with all the trouble in the Middle East, it's not beyond thinking that that could happen. If, for example, they manage to sink a couple of warships in that very narrow strait that goes into the Red Sea and make it impossible. I mean, look at the havoc that was caused when that evergreen ship just went and got itself grounded in the Suez. They could do something like that, and then the almost the entire world, and do something similar in the Suez, because it's in Egypt land, right? Egyptian land. It's no longer, it used to be part of Israel Palestine, but it's now all in Egypt. If they do that, then the whole world goes into an oil crisis that we haven't seen since the 1970s, and we've got no fuel reserves.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I think it shows you how it's just the mindset around this whole thing. And that's why I think you urge people in the newsletter, go and vote. You don't like it, go and vote. I see there's the ANC manifesto has been launched on in Durban. That was on Saturday last week. And the promises and everything continues, and it's the same drama over and over and over. But it's with dire consequences, to South Africa. The place that it will go to, and we talk about this every single week, is Argentina, where Javier Milei is now really trying to, make major strides in Argentina. And you can actually see how the bonds have actually strengthened on the back end of these reforms that he pushes through. The problem with those reforms, though, is that they are slow in the making. So you could do all these reforms today, but you're not going to see the economic fruit of it in the first year. You're going to have to wait for the economic fruit, and that's going to take time. And so so the plight of the unemployed and the plight of the poor doesn't change immediately. And I think I always wonder that if somebody is in a dire situation and they are not eating and they see somebody new coming into power, if they don't say in the first 12 months, but hang on, I'm not really getting anything out of this. Was this even worth doing in the first place? Because you can only see these benefits much later on, right, Dawn? You don't see them
Yeah.
immediately.
I think it's very interesting for us to keep looking back and seeing what is Javier Milei doing that is it working? We know that it's going to take time, and to see what kind of unrest is coming down the pipe as a result of it. One of the things, and I mean, I had to go and do a bit of research in it, their unemployment is sitting at 60%. Ours is sitting theoretically at 50%, it's probably closer to 60 or 65% or whatever. So there are a lot of similarities between the two. But going back to the budget, when you have a look and see the level of grants and how that alone, the sheer explosion of grants that have been giving, and it's not stopped because now the COVID grant has now become the almost universal credit grant, quite frankly, which is social. No, actually, it's not socialist, communist. There are aspects of socialism that are actually really quite good, even in a democratic environment. But let's talk about communism. Let's talk about, good old make everybody reliant on the government kind of story. Look, to the government's credit, they only gave minimal increases to those grants, right? But that's because they've got a whole movement going on to extend this COVID grant into a everybody grant. Going to be interesting to see whether, Javier Milei actually stays around long enough. If they keep him around long enough to actually see the fruits of it, is going to be the big thing.
I suppose this is the big thing, is that most people that vote don't understand economics. They don't understand how the fiscus works. They don't understand how monetary policy works. They just look at their plight on a daily basis. They go down the road, they try and buy bread, they say, what is the price? They look at it, they go, this is ridiculous. I want a change. That's how the majority of people globally look at economics. They don't understand the actual mechanisms behind that is being changed in order to try and affect change. And I wonder just what Javier Milei will do in order to give early wins. Because if you can feel and see the early win as the voting public, perhaps you look at that and say, hang on, there's going to be a change. And already we're seeing some of these things happening. And I wonder what that is. And I suppose it must be at the very basic needs, making sure that,
Absolutely.
people can buy a loaf of bread, or maybe it's the dollarization of that economy so that people now just actually no longer have to worry about their dwindling peso. The dollar's price is set and there's bread at a certain price. Maybe that's a couple of US cents. And at least that gives you some form of stability. Perhaps people look at that and say, well, here's an early win. And I think that's amazing.
Yeah, but I do think that you have to maybe take a step back, as you alluded to, in terms of pegging the price, subsidizing some of those very basic needs. In my newsletter that I put out on the budget, one of the things that I alluded to is that one of the ways that the government can not just fund the potentially the NHI, which my hope is that it only gets introduced in when I'm dead, right? So that's a long time in the future. So I mean, that's my plan, is that it only gets, but having said that, one of the ways that a government can actually get funds fairly quickly, because if you keep on increasing the tax rate, the taxpayers pack their bags and trek Ferrera, right? They're
Oh my
out
God.
here.
Yeah,
They're gone
correct.
to Dubai. They're gone to wherever else it is. They're already going, but they would then go en masse, right? But VAT is the one way that you spread the burden across everybody that consumes. It encourages saving and it discourages consumption. But then, of course, the poorest of the poor would have to be protected, probably with increased zero VAT, and over and above that, maybe subsidies as well.
And perhaps, I mean, take the Social Development Department and make the rules for who actually receives a grant, strengthen up on those. So it's not just a free for all. There are certain categories that just don't get a grant or a reduced grant. And there's certain categories which should get a grant. You know, those are the most vulnerable amongst society. They should get a grant. There's no problem with that. But it's ensuring that you almost create a funnel system so that you are capable of taking those that are supposed to be economically active and making them economically active and then producing the opportunity so that they can be. And the only way you're going to do that is by becoming business friendly, which is what the Indians are doing. I mean, they're trying to become more and more business friendly because they know that they can't employ a couple of billion people. They can't employ 1 billion people in India. They can't employ 100 million people in India. But you know who can? Invite Procter & Gamble, Nestlé, Unilever. You get multinationals to come put money into factories and into manufacturing concerns inside India, give them the ability to do so, and all of a sudden they employ people. And before you know it, you've achieved an economic miracle. But that requires foresight, the ability to be able to do so. And I'm hoping some of that potentially starts happening after the elections. We'll have to see. Dawn, did you look at NVIDIA this week? Wow,
I know. I know. I
what a
actually
rocket.
had quite a busy week. And with all of the clients that I was having chats with, we were discussing NVIDIA. Now, obviously, one of the things that maybe listeners don't know about me is that I'm always have been a fairly avid gamer.
There we go.
There
Have
we
you got
go.
some NVIDIA chips, Dawn? Do
Yes,
you
I
own
do.
NVIDIA chips? That's the question.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always understood the power of particularly NVIDIA GeForce. It's always been my GPU of choice, right? In fact, I've actually just had to buy a laptop because I decided I'd go with AMD instead of NVIDIA, and I found out.
Okay, well, there we go.
There we
There we
go,
go.
right?
There we go.
So, I mean, I understand it, but I do think that there's quite a lot of froth in there and there's quite a lot of hype. And because, unless you're a gamer, and listen, all the people that are buying those shares aren't gamers and they don't understand AI, right?
No,
And
no.
AI is fantastic. I mean, administrator, I won't give her name away. She might not want the exposure in that. But she and I were having a discussion, and we wanted a name for a TikTok channel. And I said, I'm not useless at it. My brain is just not in the right place to do that brainstorming. So we just said to the chatbot that, the AI chatbot that's on the bottom of my screen, what is a good name for a TikTok channel that does X work? And it came up with 20 brilliant names, and we picked one of them
There
when
we
we were there.
go.
Yeah, so
There we go.
it is powerful and it is the next best thing in many respects, but it's not, I don't think it's going to have that immediate impact. I mean, if you look at the dot-com era, right? We all thought that the internet online shopping was going to do what we are now thinking 24 years later that AI is going to do. And we got a rude awakening. It just feels a bit like that.
So I think, I mean, and I write about that in the newsletter this week, is that if you look at the success of NVIDIA, which is a chip manufacturer, and so just in case you wonder, inside your computer, inside your laptop, and that's why we're talking about gaming computers now, data centers and so on, semiconductors are critical to the running of anything that runs technology. You need semiconductors. And the semiconductor world is one that is really run by a couple of large conglomerate businesses across the world. They are either in Taiwan or they are some in Europe. And then there's quite a few in the United States. And they have got huge ties between them where sometimes, and in some cases, these chips are manufactured in such a way where one company will do one part, but another company will do a different part. So there's cross collaboration on a continuous basis. And they are basically in a race on a daily basis, trying to outdo each other in computing power. Now, it'll be no surprise to anybody to know who's won that race today. Well, that company is NVIDIA. Okay, that's why you see their founder with these leather jackets at the results presentation, and he'll tell you wax lyrical about NVIDIA and why it's a brilliant company, et cetera, and what they're busy doing. But hot on his heels is a whole bunch of other competitors trying to outdo him in this chip space. Remember, this space belonged to other competitors down the pike. Okay, these other guys who had the lead 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, and today it just happened to be NVIDIA that's in the lead. But what is different for me about NVIDIA is that it's a confluence of a whole bunch of factors. The bond market is uninvestable at this stage in the United States because, well, they're busy rejigging the whole yield curve. So you don't quite sure what kind of risk you're taking. So that's uninvestable. You could buy normal shares. That's fine. So you want to put money into the stock market. And then there's the poster child of a company that is showing parabolic growth. So if you actually look at the earnings inside NVIDIA, you look at how this has grown over a decade, this is a brilliant business. These are guys that understand semiconductors. They're not the kids around the block that try and put things together. They're actually very good. And they've reinvested into this business vast amounts of money to try and be the best. So make no mistake, NVIDIA is an absolutely brilliant company. But this massive rise in the share price is not just because they're a brilliant company. It's because there's another asset class which is uninvestable. And at the same time, central banks across the world is producing more and more liquidity into the global financial system. And it has to find a home. And that home at this stage, and it gets a large share of it, is NVIDIA. Now, Dawn, I come back to what you said. Is it frothy? Absolutely. Can they sustain this? Well, at some point, this growth that they've got will slowly start subduing because their biggest client at the moment is actually data centers. And at some point, they're going to have enough chips. They're not going to have to need more. They're going to potentially then have to order less unless NVIDIA can come up with a product that is even better than the product that they've got at the moment. So same with an Apple iPhone, right? Pick up your iPhone. Is that a great phone? Yes, it is. Is it any different to the one that is in the previous generation? Very little. Maybe a little bit of extra computing power, but there's not a lot of difference. It's highly unlikely that you're going to pick up a new iPhone that's going to be launched in 2 or 3 years' time that is going to look so fundamentally different and be so much better than the one that you've got on your table today. And that's the NVIDIA story busy playing out. Is it worth this frothy valuation? Probably not. Why would that change? Well, it'll change when data centers change their buying behavior. Or there's a new competitor that says, listen, actually, my chip is better, faster, more stable, and potentially even cheaper. Why should you buy from NVIDIA? And this is why these chip manufacturers have got huge volatility in their share prices, because they go through these sections and these iterations over time where they gain because they've done something brilliant in the technological space, and then they fall behind as other guys get ahead of them. That's really the story. So I have a question for anybody owning NVIDIA shares today. If you've bought it, it wasn't because you knew there was going to be global liquidity in the system and with a bond market that was uninvestable. You clearly believed in the company, or perhaps you just owned it because, well, you thought it was a great looking company and you liked the leather jacket the guy was wearing. And now if you've made money out of this, what are you going to be doing? Are you going to be selling or are you going to be keeping? Are you a believer or are you not a believer? So reach out to us. Let us know what you think about NVIDIA. And with that, we'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast today. It's Kirby and Dawn. Reach out to us. Go to our website. Dawn's busy putting out a whole range of blogs as well. You can go visit those and interact with us around any of those issues. Thanks for listening.